Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the State House Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of July 16th, 2019. This week, we take a look at the recent project Lethal Legacy by the Post and Courier and the Aiken Standard on how South Carolina is expected to be home to tons of plutonium for decades, this according to an internal memo obtained by the papers. The excess plutonium is housed in a 65-year-old building at the Savannah River site that federal regulators have previously rated as poor. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who are the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, I give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections instead of trying to figure out travel logistics to Area 51. Hotels are going to be crazy expensive in September. They can't stop us all. Does anyone want to split like an RV or an Airbnb? Let me know. Or while I still recover from my birthday. Yes, I'm anywhere from 25 to 33. No, we didn't get any new reviews on iTunes. I feel like I'm doing all the work in this relationship, people. Do the quorum call. Just do the horn. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present. But here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the Post and Courier reports the University of South Carolina Board of Trustees is expected to vote for the university's new president on Friday. This comes a week after a state judge blocked a previous board vote for violating state law requiring 5 days' notice. The consensus is the board has enough votes to hire retired Lieutenant General Robert Caslin, who has sparked protests across the campus. However, three trustees tell the Post and Courier they can elect a president whose name has not been shared with the public because this is a continuation of the search process. Back in April, Caslin was considered the frontrunner to replace retiring President Harris Pastides, but the board voted to continue the search because of protests against the former West Point superintendent. However, Governor Henry McMaster has pushed for a new board vote for Caslin in recent days after being upset at how the university treated him. The governor, who chairs the Board of Trustees, is expected to preside over the Friday meeting. Caslin has been criticized for not having a doctorate degree or an extensive research background, as well as for comments that some interpreted as blaming binge drinking for sexual assault. The USC faculty gave Caslin a vote of no confidence last Thursday during an emergency meeting and asked the board to conduct a new search. Republican lawmakers believe Caslin will slow tuition hikes and control costs because he does not have a traditional academic background. We'll have more on the story next week. Number two, the state newspaper reports that 37 inmates on death row have been moved to Broad River Correctional Institute. The move comes amid an ongoing lawsuit that alleges South Carolina's death row inmates spend too much time in solitary confinement. Prison officials say the primary motive for the move was to give inmates more time to socialize out of their cells than they currently have. Number three, the SC Education Lottery Commission says the lottery has raised nearly $500 million for education programs in the last fiscal year. The record $487.6 million surpassed the previous year's record of $435 million, thanks in part to the winning $1.5 billion Mega Millions ticket being claimed in March. I still have not seen my share of that money yet. Money raised through the lottery goes to the education lottery account, which state legislators can then use for scholarships, grants, K-12 programs, and community education programs. And now for our Florida Man News segment. Every week we give you a headline, just a taste of the most captivating Florida Man news. Headline, Florida Man makes threat with sword after game console loses power. We've all been there. And you know what? You're not God. You're not my father. You're not my boss. We buried the lead.
I just wanted some bagels.
South Carolina, where you can go from the mountains to the coast, or a plutonium stockpile, all within hours. That latter part doesn't make it into our tourism material, but it was the focus of a recent Post and Courier and Aiken Standard investigation. Enter the Savannah River site. The facility, still referred to as the bomb plant by some, is a likely long-term repository for several tons of plutonium, this according to internal documents obtained by the newspapers. To keep the Cold War theme going, the plutonium is stored in a 65-year-old building just 25 miles from Aiken and Augusta. Now, if you had problems sleeping at night, you might want to stop listening. Just kidding, this is important, which is why we brought back the Aiken Standard's Colin Demarest, who co-bylined the Lethal Legacy special report in both papers recently with Thad Moore. Colin is one of the state's nuclear gurus, and he stays on top of everything Savannah Riversite, and we're glad he's back.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And I just want to make sure, Colin, what we're talking about here is that we're talking about excess plutonium that was used for bombs. We're not talking about, like, nuclear waste or spent fuel rods or anything like that, right?
So basically, we're talking about 12 metric tons of surplus plutonium that's at the site. That was disclosed to me in May, I believe. Only some of that was meant for MOX, and that's a whole other thing, but I want to make that clear. Only some of that was meant for MOX.
So some of that was coming from other laboratories from across the country or
yeah,
other
so
countries?
In the story we touch on that, it was kind of all consolidated in the early 2000s era for safety kind of oversight reasons.
So, and all this plutonium was, some of it was supposed to be reprocessed. What's the story with this plutonium? Maybe we just kind of touched on it, but what was its future? What was supposed to be done with it?
So like I mentioned before, there's 12 metric tons out there. Some of it was meant for the mixed oxide fuel fabrication facility. That project was terminated in October of last year for various reasons, including money, timing, congressional controversy. The other stuff is completely separate from the MOX cache. There's kind of two, I guess, I would describe pools out there of plutonium. And one is being dilute and disposed, processed by the Department of Energy's cleanup office, which is environmental management. And then another part was meant for MOX, but that future is kind of shaky now.
Mm-hmm. And now the 12 tons, was that revealing for you to actually get a firm number on that? I mean, we always feel like we knew how much. Was there always kind of understanding about how much was
there?
There
was a rough understanding. People kind of had these rough estimates. I had always tried to nail down a number just because I was curious and I thought that was newsworthy in and of itself. But when it finally got disclosed to me, that was like one of the first times it's been firm on the head kind of in recent history.
And that was also after we shipped some to Nevada. But we'll talk about that in a minute because that's my favorite controversy in the state. But tell me about these planning documents. What did they reveal? What was the big kind of takeaway from the story here, Lethal Legacy? And what was really kind of eye-opening to you guys in this report?
So to me personally, I viewed the story kind of not as fear-mongering, not as kind of like, whoa, we're all going to die because we're not.
We're okay.
It was kind of, I feel like outside the Aiken County bubble, nuclear policy, nuclear talks, nuclear knowledge is not really common or kind of in the public consciousness. Mm-hmm. So I viewed the story kind of as, hey, this is out here. Hey, these are the conditions it's being stored in. And here is the political ramifications or the buildup to what happened. It kind of was a catch up almost, plus new information based on these documents we obtained.
And the new information illuminated what exactly that was kind of news for you guys?
I think it revealed to the average person that, hey, this plutonium might be here a lot longer than most people know, predicted, that sort of thing, which poses some issues on the local level, obviously, for us in the Aiken area, poses some state-level issues, and then obviously in Congress, in D.C., that's a major major thing to tackle.
Yeah, what's the local reaction to this? I mean, I guess everyone always kind of knew that there was
to the story?
Yeah, and maybe just like, you know, I mean, overall, and having this understanding that this, you know, you got a couple metric tons of just plutonium parked right outside the city, essentially. I mean, like, are people just used to it? I mean, it's not too far from where we are, too, so.
I was talking to someone the other week, and they said, hey, you know, Aiken wouldn't be Aiken without the site. And I think that goes back to this whole bubble thing I mentioned prior. The reaction to the story in the Aiken area, I got a bunch of emails that were like, hey, good job, great investigation, kudos to you and the Post and Courier. We also got a lot of reactions, and I think this was mainly in Aiken, that was like, so what, this isn't news. We've known this, we've been dealing with this for generations. Mm-hmm. So there's been both positive and negative feedback.
But the news is that we're going to probably have plutonium stored there, which was meant to be a temporary storage site now for two decades?
Yeah, so the story focused on K area and basically that it will be there longer than previously understood or previously disclosed, that sort of thing. And that whole where it's stored right now was not originally meant for long-term plutonium storage. It was a old reactor building basically that was retrofitted for storage.
And I mean, I think of a reactor building, I think of like a really hardcore concrete building. There was pictures of it, but you're telling me it's 65 years old and it's not in the best shape. So what's the story there? And is that comforting to know that it's maybe not as strong as it should be?
A lot of the whole nuclear complex across the nation is facing aging issues. Buildings date back to the Cold War, World War II, that sort of thing. And so it's not necessarily just Savannah Riverside specific about this whole age problem. But in terms of this story, it was kind of like this area where we're holding all this plutonium is starting to show its age. And there's deferred maintenance in the millions of dollars to kind of, you know, catch up with. And that was one of the main concerns we raised.
But then also you think about, you know, I think there was one talk about like how the roof wasn't in great condition. They fixed, I mean, have there been movements to fix up this building as much as they can?
Yeah. So that also brings in the whole congressional funding issue. But we reached out to the DOE, of course, and they caught us up on, you know, what has been done, what problems have been addressed. But there is that backlog of maintenance that needs to be taken care of at some point.
Because you did quote, there's some nuclear oversight board that looks at, you
know, the DNFSB. Yeah.
Can you say what that stands for?
Defense Nuclear Facilities Safety Board.
And so a lot of those reports, I'm guessing, I mean, you were reading from, you were quoting them. Do those go into the void, or do you feel like there are actually people reading these reports? I mean, I know those are inspectors on site.
I read them every day.
Which is comforting to know.
I think I might be like one of three people.
Yeah.
I know Thad read a bunch of them.
But do you think people that work at SRS, I mean, I'm assuming they get those forwarded to them or something like that. And like, are they seeing these reports? Are they taking note? Are they actually making improvements based on these reports?
I mean, so they're publicly available. The DNFSB has a website and they're cataloged all the way down. So anyone can read them. But I think the people out at the site are definitely aware of what's being reported in those individual dispatches.
So what more needs to happen, I guess, at this point in terms of making sure this facility is up to snuff? Are they slowly trying to get more money, or what's the word now in terms of what needs to be done to really keep that plutonium secure?
So, I mean, I would say it's secure in terms of
more secure
in
maybe.
Terms of like a terrorist busting in or something like that.
Yeah.
But like I mentioned before, it's all about money. And that falls to our congressional delegation on the Hill and that sort of thing. The more money there is, the more work that can be done, essentially. And the more money that can specifically go to this one area where we're staging our plutonium long term.
I guess we can feel safe about the fact that it is technically secure, but maybe we would want that building to be a little bit more secure. But but there's a legal situation going on with that part of that plutonium, which we were talking about, which was meant for the mixed oxide fuel facility, which is, you know, the MOX project, which we talked about last time you were on. And then there's also some issues with us sending the plutonium to Nevada, which I love to hear. but what's kind of going on right now? Like, weren't we fining the Department of Energy for having to store all this plutonium on site? And then, you know, because we weren't reprocessing it as part of the agreement, which kind of blew up. Just kind of maybe give us like a little bit of
the backgrounder kind of on this is that there was this basically rule that was enshrined that said, for every year you don't get this plutonium out of South Carolina, you're going to owe us $100 million, excuse me. And that started in 2016, 2017, 2018, you know. The state of South Carolina ended up suing the Department of Energy because the complaint was for the $200 million, 2016, 2017. That lawsuit went into settlement negotiations, and that recently, I think it was earlier this month, the parties came out and said, hey, we can't negotiate this anymore. So that lawsuit's going forward for the $200 million. In the meantime, at the end of 2017, a district judge, a federal judge, ordered the DOE to get one metric ton of plutonium out of South Carolina by 2020. As you kind of mentioned prior, that half metric ton was sent to Nevada, to the Nevada National Security Site. That angered a lot of people out in Nevada, which was kind of rehashed by this whole other new controversy that kind of cropped up recently. And the DOE and the NNSA, the National Nuclear Security Administration, all their officials have said, hey, we're going to get this other half metric ton out by 2020 for sure. So that's kind of the catch up, if that makes sense.
I mean, no one wants to be a plutonium dumping ground, right?
So that's the thing. No one really wants to take this material. And I mean, you can see it in the whole Yucca Mountain debate as well. But basically, Nevada's officials, and that includes Governor Steve Sisolak, Senator Catherine Cortez Masto, Jackie Rosen, they claim that the NNSA kind of acted like super secret, under cover of night, snuck the plutonium into their state to the Nevada National Security Site. And that really angered them because they felt like, I think the governor, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, you know, this has shredded all the trust we've ever had for the DOE.
And the whole reason that they're, you know, besides not wanting to have it stored there is that they're worried about anything happening in transport, and they're, you know, Las Vegas.
I would say exposure and all that was brought up. And I mean, Nevada did sue the DOE over this transport to prevent this transport.
But then to get rid of it, I mean, it's still going to have to go past Las Vegas again. So
I mean, to get rid of it, they're going to be sending it to Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. And that will be moved by the end of 2026, according to the Energy Secretary Rick Perry.
But so we're, like you're saying, there's still going to be a half metric ton that's going to be moved this year.
If it hasn't moved already,
yeah.
They don't openly talk about these kind of things until way after the fact for security reasons and that sort of thing. But yeah, ostensibly another half metric ton has to move out of South Carolina before this year ends.
So that'd be leaving us with like 12 metric tons of plutonium still, if that's
Yeah, roughly.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then so, again, like that going back to us suing the federal government, because that was all supposed to be reprocessed. Most of it was supposed to be reprocessed for Mox. Mox became like a $9 billion, can we say boondoggle? Can we just say money pit? I guess another nuclear money pit in the state.
Yeah.
Because then poof, it just, you know, it's done with that now. Yeah. So what's the future of SRS besides obviously just hanging on to these metric tons? Are we going to have that pit production facility down there yet? Or
so
what's the word?
A backgrounder on this as well. I mean, the whole ongoing mission at the site is nuclear cleanup. Mm-hmm. It's a environmental management landlord facility, which means, you know, clean up, close out, monitor it. There's also been a study where the National Nuclear Security Administration, the DOE's semi-autonomous nuclear stockpile and nuclear nonproliferation arm, has considered becoming the landlord at the site, which kind of shifts more focus towards the weapons and defense kind of angle. You mentioned pit production. That's still kind of a toss-up. I mean, it has to go through Congress, obviously, and there's a lot of questions in Congress about why are we splitting it between, or why should we split it between South Carolina and New Mexico?
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see right. It's not a sure mission at all. And I think a lot of people might think that, oh, we're getting pit production. We might.
Mm-hmm.
And the next big step, I would say, would be near the end of 2020 when a Department of Energy executive signs off on the specific recommendation that says, let's go forward with this. So we'll know more then.
So there's still a lot going on. It sounds like a lot in flux down at SRS.
Yes. Yes.
But could the plutonium go somewhere else? Isn't there talk about, I guess, designing an actual facility in Texas, right?
Yes.
So that
that facility would be designed specifically to hold these kinds of materials, these nuclear plutonium weapons parts, that sort of thing. It would be a dedicated kind of facility, which a lot of people, like nuclear watchers and watchdogs and kind of in the public, would have kind of wanted. And we touched on that in our story.
But that's a whiles away.
Yes. I mean, these are major nuclear ventures and that sort of thing. If you look at MOX, I mean, that was more than a decade in the making.
Mm-hmm.
And it fizzled out, essentially.
So still plenty to keep up with. And, you know, we were talking about Nevada. I'm just wondering, you know, one last question here. How do we tie this all into Area 51? Because there has to be a connection. I mean, there has to be.
I haven't found proof of aliens at SRS, so I can't speak. I'm not the subject matter expert on aliens, but I'll keep an eye out.
I mean, there's something going on here. The memes won't lie.
If you want to start a Facebook petition to storm SRS, that's all you. Yeah. I'm not signing up, but I'll cover it.
Yeah, that might be the end of my days. Well, Colin, thanks again for keeping us updated on all things nuclear. And thanks again to Thad Moore, who also co-bylined this article.
And Andrew.
And Andy Brown, too, with some great reporting.
They did
all things
a lot
nuclear,
of legwork.
Yeah, those guys, you can't talk about nuclear without those guys in the state, too. So thanks again. Go check out Lethal Legacy on the Post and Courier and the Aiken Standards websites. Thanks, Colin.
Thank you.
It's that time again for some campaign trail news updates. We're looking at the latest in 2020 related movements affecting South Carolina, state campaign news, and highlights from the state's congressional delegation. The Post and Courier reports that Senator Kamala Harris leads the pack of 2020 contenders when it comes to having the most staff on the ground in South Carolina, with 49 paid staffers. Senator Bernie Sanders has 35, and former Vice President Joe Biden's campaign expects to have the same amount by the end of the month. Florence Mayor Stephen J. Wakila has endorsed Senator Bernie Sanders for president, the campaign says. Wakila endorsed Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown earlier this year, but Brown didn't end up jumping in the race. Brown also had a message of supporting working-class voters, a reason Wakila said he's backing Sanders like he did in 2016. Wakila's brother Michael serves as the campaign's state spokesman. The state newspaper reports that 1st Congressional District Democrat Joe Cunningham has $1 million in the bank. Also, another challenger, Chris Cox of Mount Pleasant, has jumped into the growing field of Republicans looking to challenge Cunningham. Check out our episode, Low Country Roiled, for our first look at that race. Senator Lindsey Graham visited two migrant detention centers near the border in Texas with Vice President Mike Pence and others on Friday. On Fox News' Sunday Morning Futures, Graham said, "I don't care if they have to stay in these facilities for 400 days. We're not going to let these men go." And a recent Fox News poll of 701 South Carolina Democratic primary voters found that former Vice President Joe Biden has 35% support, followed by Senator Bernie Sanders with 14%, Senator Kamala Harris at 12%, Senator Elizabeth Warren at 5%,
Senator Cory Booker at 3%, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg at 2%. Other candidates were at 1% or less. You can see the entire poll in our show notes. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is back with some state trivia? Here he is. Russ, hello, welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
What we got?
Well, last time we were here, I think we talked about hurricanes, which was kind of timely, since we've had Tropical Storm and briefly Hurricane Barry, I believe was the name of it. You know, this year in South Carolina...
We didn't plan that, by the way. Sorry.
It's fine. This year across South Carolina, we've had pretty much traditional summertime weather, the way the traditional weather patterns are in the state, where hot, sunny days with a good chance of thunderstorms developing late in the afternoon and early in the evening. That the last several years, we really hadn't done that. We've been in a kind of a hot, dry period. Mm-hmm. But so far this year, we're back to traditional summer weather patterns for South Carolina.
Wrath of God days,
yes. But did you know that the single most important factor influencing our summer weather in South Carolina is, ready?
I'm ready.
A, the jet stream. B, the Gulf Stream. C, the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Come on now.
D, the Bermuda High. One of those four.
I want to say the Bermuda High. I've never really heard of it, though. I mean, I know the Gulf Stream. Gulf Stream, I think, that goes with the Gulf. Lower jet stream, I think, is up north. Yankees. They just call it the Yankee Stream, am I right? Yeah, I think the Gulf Stream, just because it's sending all that moisture, is the correct term. You think it's the Bermuda High? I don't remember the last time someone said, oh, and the Bermuda High is affected. I mean, it could be. I'm going to go with Gulf Stream.
Well, the Gulf Stream, you know, is that warm water current that comes up in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of the United States, and it's fairly close in South Carolina. I think you can, in a boat leaving somewhere like Edisto Beach, you can be in the Gulf Stream, in the Gulf Stream in an hour, something like that. So it comes in pretty close there. But the answer is D, the Bermuda High.
Oh, the Bermuda High.
Oh, brother, this guy stinks!
The Bermuda High is an extremely high-pressure cell. It sits out over the center of the Atlantic.
Ah.
And the clockwise motion causes moist, warm weather to come up across South Carolina from the Gulf, the Caribbean, and the Gulf of Mexico, and the lower Atlantic. And that generally sets our weather pattern, especially in the summer. Occasionally, though, that Bermuda High will stall out. And when it's stable, we get those hot, dry summers like we've seen for the last several years.
Does the Gulf Stream have anything to do with Bermuda High? It sounds like it might be interconnected there. We can maybe get a half point.
Well, actually, all of these affect South Carolina's weather. The Blue Ridge Mountains many times allow the Bermuda High to do what it does because it blocks westerly flows of fronts coming towards South Carolina. So in a way, they're all connected. But the Bermuda High is the single most important factor.
Very good. Well, here we go with some great trivia. Thanks, Russ.
Sure.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on SCETV.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. Follow us on Instagram at @SCLeadPod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle at @SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to SCLEDE@SCETV.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Aiken Standard. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Sean Scott is our intern. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia, July 15th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. The lead is governed by maritime law, and we record in international waters. That was a foghorn. Okay, bye.
I am smelling toast every morning.